This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Garrett Wong. I played Ensign Harry Kim on Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey. To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, are...
Suzanne Williamson and...
Kay Shaw.
So today, we are going to be discussing one of my all-time favorite Voyager episodes, the sixth season episode, Dragon's Teeth. But rumor around Trek FM is that Dragon's Teeth is not either of your favorite episodes.
That is correct.
It's not my favorite. I don't hate it or anything. I don't find as much in it to enjoy as some other episodes.
It just doesn't do anything for me. It puts Seven doing things that she wouldn't do. It takes her out of her character. I don't see her waking up all these people.
It takes Seven of Nine out of her character? I never even thought of that. You got to explain this.
I could see her doing this, like, you know, when she's first taken out of the Borg, but... At this point in season six, to have her be the one to wake Gedrin up, it makes no sense to me. Why would she do this?
See, I thought that at first, but then later on she says something that makes me go, oh, maybe that's what this is all about. Because later on she says, oh, as a drone, I helped to assimilate all these civilizations, but now I have the opportunity to help reconstruct one, and I find the idea gratifying. So I was like, maybe that's what she's... Maybe that's
but
what
she
she's
knows better.
Into. She does know better.
Because she knows better because she, like, chides Janeway for doing similar things.
Yeah, no, I get that. But I just... Because she said that, and I thought, oh, that's really interesting, because we've not really heard her say anything like that before.
To me, it would have made more sense to have Neelix do it.
Well, yeah, but you can't play the Neelix card every episode.
No, but to have 709 do it, it was very vaudoir.
I'm just a little surprised she didn't get to use her nanoprobes to wake them up, because that's such a Seven thing.
That is true.
Nanoprobes. Wake them up.
You can't always rely on your nanoprobes.
Or she didn't get to use her nanoprobes to, like, destroy them all later or steal their subspace
yeah,
corridor.
Yeah, you gotta give the writers whatever. Credit. They didn't rely on nanoprobes this time.
Just the once. Just the one time.
Yeah, she could have used the nanoprobes to, like, remap the subspace corridors. That would have been cool.
She could have just completely rebuilt the subspace corridor home to Earth with nanoprobes.
Or make them all collapse.
Yeah.
So other than this one relatively minor plot point that it doesn't quite make sense for Seven of Nine to wake up the Vaudoir, what don't you love about this episode? I think this episode is fascinating. You get to see a whole ancient civilization resurrected. It's like being able to resurrect the Roman Empire or something.
But then we never see these people again.
Yeah, like, we don't ever really find out what happened.
They just disappear. We never mention them again. Nothing. Just gone.
Even though Janeway says at the very end, oh, I'm sure we haven't seen the last of them, hint, hint.
Yes, we have.
It did feel like they were looking for the next alien race to be the bad guys, like, the, you know, make these guys the Cardassians of the Delta Quadrant or something.
Yeah.
We should have put them in our movie.
And Progenitors too.
Yay!
Yes, when we write Progenitors 2, the Vaudoir are making an appearance. It would be foolish for us to do otherwise.
Everyone make note.
All races beginning with V will reappear in our movie.
Vadians!
Vulcans! We'll find some Vulcans in the Delta Quadrant.
There have to be some. Caretaker was bringing everybody. He didn't care anymore.
Yeah, yeah. He's bound to have got some Vulcans in there somewhere. I get what you're saying. I think the concept is really interesting, but I think the execution's just a bit meh.
You didn't find the episode riveting?
No.
I kind of did. I thought it was a great story. You know, you either wake up these aliens, they're thrown into the middle of this ancient war, there's kind of a plot twist where the good aliens are actually kind of the bad aliens. I think it's great. Maybe I'm a little simplistic, but I really like that.
Yeah, but I feel like, I guess what I think is missing for me, and I do understand all that, is the fact that I just didn't really connect with it emotionally. Like, I just didn't really care about the Vaudois. I was like, yeah, whatever, Vaudois. Yeah.
You don't sympathize with this guy looking out on the ruins of his home world. You know, for him, it was just like yesterday, and it was like a real world. Now
he wasn't that sad, though, so I wasn't going to be sad for him.
He was the one that ruined it.
He was a bit stoic about the whole thing.
Well, he does. That's right, right? They don't, you know, cower and hide from the rain. They walk upright with dignity. He is a little stoic about it.
He didn't even really choke up that his wife was
dead. Exactly.
Just like, oh, yeah, she's dead. Seriously, dude.
Yeah, I do agree. I think that's quite a big factor, actually, in why I just didn't really connect with the guy and didn't really have any sympathy for him. Because I was like, he's just like, oh, my wife died. Yeah, well, whoops.
Poor Jisa. Whatever.
That's how it goes sometimes.
Moving on.
You know, you win some, you lose some.
Let's wake up everybody else.
It's a little bit Klingon, right? In the episode, Gedrin is talking to B'Elanna, and he's kind of saying, you know, hey, I've been looking through your database, and I respect these Klingons. He uses the phrase, today is a good day to die. And so he's really stoic, like the Klingons. I think it totally works.
But when Jadzia died, Worf was a little upset.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Worf's not like a real Klingon. Worf's like an idealized Klingon.
Dude! Say that to his face. I dare you.
Worf is not a real Klingon. Worf is a really rubbish Klingon who read about being Klingon in a book once and is like, oh, I rock at this. And all the other Klingons are like, seriously, dude.
I can agree that his son Alexander is not a real Klingon, but Worf is a Klingon. Come on, guys.
B'Elanna's not any better of a Klingon. She just wants to curl up with a good
book. She's only half Klingon, though, so she's got an excuse. I did love how she completely dismisses the guy. She's just like, no, you're talking rubbish. I want a book, mate. She didn't say Klingon romance novel, but we all heard that, right?
Yeah, totally. That's a given. That's what she wanted.
Yeah.
There's something to the stoicism, though. I mean, the fact that they fall asleep at night imagining a different way to die. It's like, you know, they're prepared for anything. They can handle anything. They can handle the destruction of the
really
world.
Disturbing.
They can handle the death of his wife.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest.
Kind of psychopathic.
It's psychopathic? It's preparing for the
Who
worst.
Who else is going to do that? No. That's not preparing for the worst. He's not a prepper. It's just creepy.
He's not a prepper, like a doomsday prepper.
He's not a prepper.
Well, they did have
He's
doomsday.
He's prepping for the rapture, man.
The zombies are coming and I'm ready.
He's going to vanish into thin air into one of those subspace corridors.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. I think the comparison to the Klingons almost highlights maybe even the reason why I don't connect with this episode, because I just think they're really one-dimensional. I get it. I think the stoicism thing is really interesting because it's not dissimilar in some ways to what we see with Vulcans. And I really like Vulcans, and we get lots of other interesting stuff about Vulcans because, you know, they have the whole stoic idea and not getting over-emotional about things. But I don't know, he just seemed really cold. The guy just was, it was just really cold. The way that he sort of, when they were talking, you know, him and Janeway, when they're looking out over the city, she calls him heartless and he's like, well, he doesn't see it heartless. He just sees it as like preparation or whatever. But it did just feel very cold and heartless to me anyway.
Very one note.
I was only half joking when I made the analogy with the Roman Empire, because these guys are essentially the Romans. They had trade routes and they were exploring and they were conquering, but it was all done in the name of trade and exploration, and really they were conquerors. And that's kind of the paradox of our own history, right? We have these empires that made great things happen and exploration and science, and yet they were also conquerors. And I think the story Janeway offers in terms of the alternative history of the Vaudoir is fascinating. And I love that Gedrin says, well, both versions are actually true. We did explore and we did innovate and we did, you know, lead to great things, but we also expanded our territory and we were conquerors. And it's this idea that alternative versions of history can both be true, I find really interesting.
Well, it always depends on who's telling the tale.
Yeah, and also the Romans weren't really cold and emotionless. Have you read their literature, dude?
So which one of the Vaudoir was fiddling as the planet burned? Yeah. If they're Romans. Which one was Nero?
That is the question.
I don't know if I'm reaching here, but it occurred to me that maybe the name Gaul is not an accident. Like, it reminds me of Julius Caesar going out and conquering in the Gallic Wars.
I assume that was intentional, at least in a passing sense, even if it wasn't supposed to be an obvious reference.
No, I don't think it was supposed to be an obvious reference. I think it's supposed to be subtle for cool people, I guess, who get the reference.
Yeah, we're cool, Zach.
So Michael Taylor put that in there on purpose, then.
Totally.
Just to see who caught it.
That is so not an accident.
I could see that.
Because this is essentially Julius Caesar going out on the Roman roads, which are trade routes and whatnot, conquering Gaul.
So who does that make the Terrae, then? If the Vaudois are the Romans?
The Visigoths.
The Visigoths.
The Beaker folk.
They're the other people. Yeah. Yes.
The ones who conquered the Romans in turn, right? The Roman Empire fell and they were conquered. Mm-hmm. So the Terrae are the conquerors of Rome.
They are.
That's how I see this episode. And that's why I think it's epic, even though it's a little shallow.
Oh, yeah, it is epic. And I do really like the concept. I don't dislike the concept. I think the concept is great, but I don't know, it just lacks something for me.
Well, it lacks characters I actually care about. If all the Vaudoir got killed in the first act, I wouldn't have shed a tear, and that doesn't say a lot for the characters. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know we had like 3 or 4 different characters in there, didn't we? But they were all very...
They're all kind of the same.
Yeah. I mean, I know you get the one guy at the end who's kind of like, oh, not all our people are the same. Well, him going, oh, well, not all our people are the same is the only bit where they didn't appear to be entirely the same.
Mm-hmm. They also could have done a little bit more with the makeup. I mean, they were going in a great direction with like the snake-looking neck, but well, then
they were Cardassians.
They left a completely humanoid face. It's like, no, you were going somewhere with this. Finish it.
I really feel like, well, yeah, the makeup sure absolutely looked a little undone, but I got the sense they were trying to kind of make a Cardassian analogy with these guys, that they were going to become the new bad guys for a couple of seasons, and they were going to kind of be like the Delta Quadrant's version of the Cardassians, and then it petered out and they didn't use it again.
It's a Cardassian with a thyroid problem. That's why his neck is
Oh, Blair.
Oh, Gold Ducat, you got to get your thyroid check, buddy.
Seriously, Ducat, man, you've let yourself go.
Even though I've kind of said already that I like the stoicism, I love Gedrin's quote that when it's raining, you don't cower and hide and run. You accept that it's raining and walk with dignity. I think that's such a good lesson, that you can cower and run from all kinds of things in life, but you got to just take it as it comes and maintain your dignity and deal with things as they come. I think that's a good lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a bit like the British stiff upper lip idea, which...
Yes, totally. You should relate to this.
I'm not convinced it's always the best idea.
You've got such a stiff upper lip, Kay.
I'm sorry, but if my hair is done, I'm running through the rain.
You know, I'm not joking. When it rains and I'm out in public and I see people cowering, I actually remember this episode and I purposely like stand tall and I don't use my umbrella and I just walk with purpose.
I would trip you in public so fast.
I totally do. I'm not joking. I totally remember this episode every time it's raining and I see people cowering from the rain.
Wow. See, this is because you work from home and you don't have to get to the office and be soaking wet.
I know. It sounds like I got to get out more or something.
Plus, I mean, like, how much does it actually rain in California?
A couple times.
Well, according to a song, it never rains
exactly,
in California.
Exactly. That was where I was going.
But when it pours, man, it pours.
I'm from the Bay Area.
So it's fog all the time.
Actually, right now it's like 108 degrees.
And he has no air conditioning, folks.
Yeah, do you catch me hiding and running and cowering from the heat wave? No, no, I hold my head high and I'm doing my podcast with dignity, even though it's 108 degrees here.
You stick yourself in a freezer.
Or a lake or something.
And go eat some ice cream. Get a 99.
Get a 99.
So it sounds like I'm the only one that really relates to this quote. This is one of my favorite quotes in all of Voyager, honestly.
Seriously?
Seriously. I love it. I think it's a brilliant quote.
I do like the quote.
It's not better than the fear quote.
No, it's not.
Nothing's better than the fear quote.
I do like it. I don't know if it, maybe it's just the way it's presented. I don't know.
Yeah. It's just very one note and flat for me.
If Tuvok had said it, we'd have been like,
oh. How very logical,
how very,
Tuvok.
How very logical and philosophical.
Well, they don't get a lot of rain on Vulcan either.
No, that
you.
Is true.
No, it's a little warm there.
That's probably why they haven't got any quotes about rain.
I love the idea of these stiff upper lip Vulcans walking around with an umbrella in the rain.
When it rains on Vulcan, because it rains so rarely, it's like a reenactment from Singing in the Rain. They all go a bit...
That's pretty much what happens in Vegas, because it doesn't rain there very much. In the 4 years I lived there, every time it rained, we were all like, we must go outside and stand in the rain and just sort of stare at the sky.
That is what Vulcans do. They'd totally be outside staring at the sky, getting rained on.
So there are a lot of cute moments in this episode, like the moment with Neelix and Naomi, where Naomi doesn't want to play with the Vaudoir children because they're making fun of Neelix. And what, I mean, these are great little scenes.
I like that bit. I thought that was really interesting, actually. Not just because of what she says, but just because of other thoughts that it brings up. Because she kind of says, oh, the other kids are being mean about you and I don't want to play with them. And I get that. But then you start thinking about how she hasn't really been around other kids and how is this like a symptom of the fact that she's just not got the skills and ability to interact with other children. And that just brought up lots of thoughts in my head about Naomi and her being on Voyager and everything else. And then I thought, that's something I wish that they'd explored more.
Well, children can be very cruel. And I'm sure, you know, Naomi has been cruel at some point. We just haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But yeah, kids are kind of mean.
I've seen her berate Flotter on the holodeck.
Well, that is well-deserved because Flotter, you know,
He's a bit Vaudoir.
I hadn't really considered this. So you're saying that because Naomi hasn't had a chance to play with other children, that she doesn't understand the meanness of other children in general. That makes sense.
It's not something that she's used to, like kids teasing each other. And I know kids get upset when they get teased by other kids, but I just feel like because of the fact that she's not been used to other children, this is something that she takes a lot more to heart than I think other kids would do.
Well, Tuvok makes fun of Neelix. How come she doesn't get mad at Tuvok?
Yeah, it's Tuvok.
He's just being logical about it, so it doesn't come across as him.
I don't think he makes
fun
in quite that way. He just...
Oh, he totally does, with his stiff Vulcan upper lip.
He's just sly about it.
Yeah, but the thing is, everything that Tuvok says about Neelix is empirically true, whereas...
Well, Neelix's ears are funny, in all fairness.
Well, yeah, but I don't think he says to him, your ears are funny or whatever, you know.
No, because then Neelix could throw that right back on
you. Your ears are funny too, Tuvok.
You know, don't mess with the ears when you've got pointy ears.
Just going to have some kind of weird ear contest. It's a slow day on Voyager. Tom Paris is there. Right, everybody, we're going to play a quick game of whose ears are the weirdest. That's one of the things they did when they were like in night. They got so bored.
I would say Kes's ears are the weirdest.
Oh, yeah, we got Kes in there if we're going to have a weird ear contest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's all for the weird ears.
Yeah.
So speaking of Neelix, though, what do you guys think of the Talaxian nursery rhymes? Things like the tale of the boy who lost his head.
Yeah, I liked those.
Those are pretty fun.
I did enjoy that.
This is some of the great stuff in the episode. The way he kind of deadpans, not exactly Mother Goose.
Well, it's like the Grimm fairy tales. They're not exactly Mother Goose either.
Oh, yeah. No, I liked it. And I liked the fact that we got Neelix be the one that figured the thing out.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was through this interesting method of doing it.
Yeah, why was he on such a quest to basically space Google the Vaudoir?
It's Neelix. He noogled.
Well, is this a plot point I missed? Did Captain Janeway order him to do it? Or is he just kind of taking it upon himself to figure out what the connection is to Vaudoir and the old tongue of Talaxian? What is it? Talaxil
Z? A little nugget that got stuck in his brain and kept poking at him. You know, when you think of something and you're like, I know there's something here, but I can't quite figure it out.
Because he just goes to the computer, doesn't he? And he says, can you find, like, define the word Vaudoir? Because he knew it meant foolish, but then it came up with these other meanings. And then when he asked it, oh, what was the first usage? That's when it brought these stories up. And then when he read those, he realized that maybe they weren't exactly what they said they were. So I don't think he set off intending to do that. I think that just kind of organically happened.
He fell into the Google holes.
He did fall into the Google holes.
You're searching for something, and then you go into another hole and another hole, and next thing you know, you're on YouTube watching cat videos.
Yep.
But as the morale officer and, you know, the Federation's Delta Quadrant ambassador, he kind of committed a faux pas. He called the new alien species foolish.
He did, right there
with everyone watching, so maybe he was embarrassed.
Maybe.
At least he didn't put his hands on his hips.
But those names of those stories, they were all a bit creepy, weren't they? There wasn't even a fluffy one in there. They were all about demons and bloody hands.
Demon with the golden voice, the tale of the deadly stranger, the tale of the boy who lost his head, and the tale of the bloody hand.
Not exactly Mother Goose.
No.
I wonder if he'd read those to Naomi later on. I got a bedtime story for you.
I'm wondering if anybody's written those stories now.
Oh, yeah. Especially the bloody hand one.
Again, this all just speaks to why I find this episode interesting, though. I would love to meet a human being from 1,000 years ago. That would be really interesting. I think it's weird that they, kind of talk the same language and the guy knows how to use the computer when he's entering the, access code to the satellite on Voyager's console and stuff. There's a lot of stuff that just doesn't kind of make sense. But it would be cool to meet someone from 1,000 years ago and get their take on things. Think how different a worldview would be over 1,000 years. Like, look what people in our own world believed 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
That would be fascinating.
I think they would try to kill you first.
That's what I was going to say.
Not everyone was like a barbarian 1,000 years ago. They were civilized people 1,000 years ago.
You'd be like a witch warlock to them with all your technology and stuff.
Yeah.
They'd be burning you at the stake.
On the other hand, Romans, to go back to the Roman metaphor, the Romans had paved roads and plumbing and all kinds of stuff that is very familiar.
Oh, yeah. But, after the Romans and sort of the Greeks and stuff, and the Egyptians, civilization kind of went backwards a bit, didn't it? And kind of started again.
Okay, so you got to go back to 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Okay.
It's still going a little backwards right now.
I think ancient Greece would be cool.
I mean, if you had the chance to resurrect the Roman Empire or ancient Greece, say Athens or something, wouldn't that be amazing? What a cool idea. I just get off on that idea.
I would like to talk to the Oracle at Delphi. That would have been pretty cool.
Greece would be cooler. I could get to meet Xena, Warrior Princess.
I don't think she was there.
Hey, you don't know that. That show is 100% historically accurate.
In Kay's ancient world headcanon, Xena the Warrior Princess was real.
Lucy Lawless will tell you.
And Gabrielle. Don't forget Gabrielle. And Jox the Mighty.
Did you detect the slightest hint of genuine humility in the guy when he says, only foolish people would let this happen to their world? I think he really believed that. There's a lesson there. This is an analogy for us. We might blow ourselves up one day.
Oh, yeah.
Only vaudoir people would let this happen.
Well, I assumed that when they ended up having to freeze themselves into stasis pods because they'd managed to get their entire world bombed to within an inch of existence, they realized that it was a bit silly what they'd done. So, yeah, I think they'd figured that out at that point.
I don't know, but no one else seems all that humble. It's just Gedrin.
Well, he was more the scientist, wasn't he? He was more of a scientist, whereas everybody else was a bit more... I don't know. We don't find out enough about everyone. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And it's almost this trope, really, that we see over and over again in Star Trek, where we get the world where the silly people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, except for this one guy that wants the humans to come help him or the Federation to come help him. We see that a lot.
I do totally sympathize with Gaul, though, when Captain Janeway is saying, I want you to deactivate all your weapons except for 10 ships. He's kind of going, where do you get off telling us to deactivate our weapons? There's only 600 of us left.
Like, dude, I will put you back to sleep.
Back in your stasis pod.
Yeah, and I think this actually brings up probably what I think is the most interesting point over all of this episode, which is that, again, we get to see this debate between Janeway going, we don't get involved in this sort of thing, but as soon as there's an opportunity for us to potentially get home faster... Not getting involved seems to go out of the window, and that is something that is a theme.
Well, yeah, from the very beginning of the episode, she's ready to side with the Vaudoir, largely out of selfish reasons, like, they've got these
corridors. Because they've got the corridors, so
buddy up with these people.
Her judgment is coloured of, oh, well, because they've got this thing that might get us home, you know, sooner, we're going to help them without really finding out exactly what they're all about first.
Never mind that prime directive. I don't need to pay attention to that this week.
But in all fairness, Janeway is running the risk of having her ship boarded by the Turei.
Well, now she's going to be boarded by the Vaudoir. They're going to take her ship.
Well, yeah, now, once they switch sides or show their true nature, show their Cardassian side.
Yeah, okay. But she's all ready to leave. And then it's only when the guy says, oh, well, are you going to leave us to be slaughtered again? Oh, help us and we'll show you the way through these corridors. And then she's all interested in helping them. Before that, she was all interested in just getting the heck out of there. So it's like this tug of war that we see over and over again with Janeway. And I just always find it really interesting whenever we see it that she wants to go down the Starfleet line and she wants to do what she's supposed to do and she wants to follow protocol. But as soon as there's an opportunity for her to assuage the guilt that she's got about the fact that she stranded everybody out here, we're going to go there.
I mean, we kind of jokingly said that Janeway would say, get back in your stasis pods. But really, you know, what's the other alternative, right? They woke them up, and now what are they going to do with them? They can either let them, you know, struggle and suffer on this dying planet, or they can try to help them out in some way. So they can't put them back in the stasis pods, presumably. They could, maybe, but...
Yeah,
they could. Back in the pod.
From the very beginning of the episode.
Yeah, you say that, but it is only when the guy says, we'll help you use our corridors, that she said she'll stay. Before that, she's all ready to just leave him there.
Enjoy your nuclear winter.
Hey, we've woken you up. Enjoy your, yeah.
Our bad, sorry.
Here's your umbrella.
We can totally let you download our database. We have this game called Fallout. If you just kind of watch that... Yeah, sorry about the giant
you'll be okay.
Tentacle creatures and stuff, but you'll be fine.
Watch out for those blood bugs.
Here's 600 replicated umbrellas. Good luck.
Yeah, don't go in the water.
I hope you find a Nuka-Cola.
Yay, Nuka-Cola!
Well, one thing, the episode was originally planned as a two-hour movie.
Right.
So like a two-hour episode, which to me might have made it a little more interesting and I might have gotten into it a little bit more. Because it seems like there was a lot missing.
Yeah. I felt like there were chunks missing out of the episode. I do agree. Like I said, you know, everything that you've said that you like about it is about the concept. And I do like the concept. I think it's a great idea, but I just don't know whether it's the best executed episode.
I agree with that. I'm kind of a concept guy, totally. Mm. And I think that's what I love about a lot of Star Trek episodes, and Voyager in particular, because Voyager has some weird stuff in it. Sometimes I get the sense that it's like Brannon Braga sitting around going, what kind of weird premise could I come up with? And then let's write the whole episode around that. Yeah, and that's essentially what we got. What if there was this alien race that was woken up? Okay, boom, let's write the whole episode around that. And even if the execution is off, it's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
And that doesn't bother me because, you know, like I said, I'm an idea guy, so... Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting thread for me with this episode is, as we've already said, whether or not we think it's the right thing that she necessarily would have done, Seven takes the decision to wake this guy up. And everybody else is kind of like, well, you probably shouldn't have really done that, but they're not that angry with her. And then everybody just kind of goes with it.
Yeah, it was out of character for a lot of people.
As soon as there's this opportunity to get home faster, everybody's suddenly on board with whatever they're doing. And whilst I agree that that potentially leads to out-of-character stuff, I like that. I like the fact that they are who they are, and most of them are very much, we do the Starfleet thing. I know we've got the Marquee and everything, but they've agreed to do the Starfleet thing and so on and follow all the rules and, you know, this is how we do everything. But I just really like how as soon as there's an opportunity for us to accomplish what we're trying to do faster, they're fighting against the fact that, oh, well, maybe actually we should have thought about whether or not this was the right thing to do before we just plunged straight into it because we're going to get an opportunity to get a bit close to home.
But I guess this doesn't bother me because consequences in general are kind of unpredictable, right? You don't know what's going to happen. Once you wake up the aliens, like, you don't know who they are, what their motive is, or what's going on. But you do find out that they've got a tool you can use to get home, and I get that. It's kind of like in Star Trek The Next Generation, like the episode Pen Pals, you know, Data makes first contact with a girl on a dying planet. And he's not supposed to. He violated the Prime Directive. But once you've done it, it's like, okay, now we have to live with the situation. Do we help or do we not help? And they end up helping in that episode of The Next Generation. And here it's like, okay, we woke them up. We shouldn't have, but they're awake now. And they've got this tool we can use. Why not use it? The damage is already done. We're already committed. That just doesn't bother me.
No, I'm not saying that it bothers me. I'm just saying that I think that it's a really interesting theme through Voyager generally, that we always see this idea that there's almost this tug of war between... we do what we do because we're Starfleet and this is how Starfleet are and these are the principles on which essentially underpin our entire society, because obviously Starfleet is like just that particular branch of the Federation. This is what underpins it all, but because they've got this overriding impetus to get home, and it becomes... I know they're going to want to get home because they've got lost, but it becomes this weird obsession, more almost than it should, because it gets to a point where it's like, well, you've just been trying to get home for so long now and you've built this life here. You've almost forgotten why you were trying to get home in the first place. And yet it's become so much of a big deal trying to get home. That is the number one thing. And therefore it overrides everything else. And I like the fact that that is something that we see played out over and over again. I really like that, because I just think that makes sense, that that's how it would be.
It sounds like you're not really taking Captain Janeway at her word when she says, we'll just go it alone and go through open space if we have to.
Yeah, but I get that. That's when she's got already embroiled in it. And she's like, oh, actually, no, you're not who we thought you were. Now I need to try and backpedal. But my point is... she would have never got that far down the line where she suddenly realised that actually we shouldn't maybe be involved with these people unless there was that impetus. Because if it was for anything else, she would have made all those steps to make sure they were who they said they were before she did it. It's just the fact that they had this way of getting home that made her go, ooh, yeah. blinkers on.
It's like she's dipping her toe in the pool, but now she fell in the deep end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's made a similar mistake. Hmm. And I can't remember the alien name, but when they brought all the Kazon together and they were having a meeting, and the guy that she had sided with wanted to just blow up all the Kazon that were in the room.
Well, Janeway takes risks, and Chakotay's always the one saying, oh, no, Captain, it's too risky.
Are you bringing up Scorpion?
Yeah, totally.
Is that what you're doing right now?
That is absolutely a Scorpion reference.
Well, we do get a Scorpion-esque Chakotay reeled out of goodness knows where quote in this episode that I love, which gives us the title of the episode, just like it does in Scorpion.
Yes. It is a very good quote, which I had it right here.
An old Greek myth. After a dragon was killed in a war, its teeth were spread out over the battlefield. They took root and warriors sprung from the ground to continue the fighting.
And Chakotay's the only one that could have said that.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Because coming from anybody else, it would have been like, huh?
Maybe this is like my inner warrior coming out. It's like, oh, yeah, we're like rising from the ashes, ready to go fight
Channel
the battle.
Channel your inner warrior, Zach.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going all...
Channel
going
your
all,
inner tooth.
I'm going all Klingon Vodwar in you guys. So
now, the question that I have is... did you put on your lorica and brandish your shield whilst you were watching this episode?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I got my breastplate here. I got my
marvelous
spear. And yeah,
I would expect nothing less from you.
So that's interesting, because I'd actually... it's amazing you remember that that's a Greek thing, because I kind of forgot.
Only because I wrote it down.
So I had kind of been connecting the Vodwar with the Romans, but here we've got this connection to Greek warriors. You know, is there anything interesting to draw out there, or is it... it's just the connection to the ancient world is interesting. I like the idea, but does it matter that it's a Greek myth versus this Roman line that I've been drawing?
No, I'm not sure they've really... no. I felt a bit more like what they'd done was they'd just done a bit of an ancient world's analogy in general, rather than try...
like a mishmash.
Rather than trying to be specific, yeah. That's how it felt to me anyway. I think they just sort of, they'd used a bit of Roman, a bit of Greek, that type of thing as the influence for some of the ideas behind it without sticking to anything particularly rigid. It was more inspired by than a reenactment of. But there are some nice little character moments in this episode.
Any other favorites besides the one we've already mentioned?
Well, I mean, we talked about Neelix and Naomi already, but I did like her little hand puppet that we didn't get to actually see properly. What was that? Was it like a little mouse or something?
I don't know.
Well, I like the idea of it being a mouse, because that ties up with the other little mouse quote in this episode that I love at the beginning. There's an amazing quote at the beginning of this episode.
Oh, what? I'm not sure I remember. What is it?
Janeway's saying to Tom Paris about getting out of the subspace corridor, and he says it's like a maze, and she just goes, well, be a good rat and find us the cheese.
That's a great line. That's so funny.
That cracked me up. That is a quote that you never would have got in any other series of Star Trek and never would have got in Voyager earlier than this point. That was just a very Voyager family quote thing for me, yeah. Like a familiarity nice thing, and I just really liked it. It was funny, but also it was really, really Voyager.
Well, it shows how close they've become, yeah. Where they've got their own kind of banter on the bridge that wouldn't happen on any other mm-hmm. starship.
Bridge-based banter. We love it.
You can't picture Captain Picard saying a line like that. Now, be a good data. Mouse, Wesley. Get the cheese.
Be a good mouse. Get the cheese. No.
Wesley.
Never.
Definitely not Kirk. He would not say that to Sulu.
No.
I could picture someone like Dax on Deep Space Nine saying a line like that.
Well, yeah.
I love the idea of Picard telling Wesley, be a good mouse, Wesley, and bring us the cheese. It's so weird.
And then he'd be like, shut up, Wesley.
Shut up, Wesley.
I think my overriding feelings about this episode is I like the idea of it, but I wanted more. I think that's probably my best way of summing it up.
I mean, fundamentally, I just wanted them to come back because they were such, you know, I mean, they basically say, oh, there's, you know, they've got 54 of these ships out there and whoa, you know, we might see them again. And then we never do. And that sucks, right?
Yeah.
Just bring them back.
That was a missed opportunity. Definitely.
Well, yeah. And I feel as well, when this has been done in season 6 and we're well into the end point of the show, you know, we're thinking about how this is all going to finally play out, that they would put something like that in without actually having a solid plan to bring them back surprises me.
So I feel like we need Larry Nemechek here to tell us whether they plan to bring them back.
Yeah, we should message Larry and ask him. I mean, we do also get the nice scene with Seven and Janeway at the end.
I think there's another good lesson here, which is that I really fundamentally believe that if you took some ancient Romans or some ancient Greek people and you brought them into the future and taught them a little bit of stuff about the modern world, they're humans just like we are, and they would be able to function just fine. So Seven of Nine kind of says, oh, their technology's out of date, we don't have to worry about them. But Captain Janeway says, no, you don't understand. These are resourceful people. Mm. They will adapt. And that's a great lesson to Seven, right? She's always the one who's always talking about adapting and Borg stuff. And Seven needs to understand that, you know, smart, resourceful, intelligent beings will be able to thrive no matter what environment you put them in.
Yeah, they'll be able to thrive and take your stuff. Like, didn't they learn from reading about Kirk and Khan? You don't just randomly wake up people, because then you end up with Khan.
It's an interesting idea, though. Like, suppose you did, like, bring Julius Caesar into the 21st century, and what would he do? Would he start immediately plotting to conquer something? Probably.
I think he would.
Yeah.
I think he would, too. And so the Vaudois are going to be who they are, and they're going to become a force of nature no matter what time period they're in. No matter what tools they've got.
No time has passed for them, has it? So they wake up and they're still
fighting the war. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a deep takeaway, but I just think it's fascinating in terms of like an interesting thought experiment. I think if you took an ancient person from an ancient world who is reasonably intelligent and had reasonable skills, you could plunk them down now or even into the future with different tools, and they would immediately go to work being who they are. That's such a cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, it would depend on the circumstances and stuff, how much capability they had to do that, but they're not going to stop being who they are.
No. Leopard doesn't change his spots. No.
It's kind of like the scorpion metaphor again. Mm.
Chakotay and his wisdom.
Dragon's teeth and scorpions.
It's in my nature.
Well, yeah, I liked that. And I think it's an interesting point that he actually makes with that quote, which is all these other species, especially the Terrae, who have obviously taken these corridors over. They've thought for a long time that these guys are dead and gone. And yet, well, hey, we're back. You know, they're like, oh, we're being chased by the Vardwad. That's impossible. Well, actually, I think you're going to be surprised.
I mean, really, how much would the Terrae remember of the Vardwar?
Well, I assume it's all in the history books, but I mean, if they're fighting an interstellar war at the time when this happens, they're going to have that all recorded, aren't they?
Ago?
Well, 892 years.
Nobody's that up on history.
Some people are.
Except for Tom Paris and the 20th century.
Well, yeah, I get that. But it's kind of like now people going, oh, the Egyptians are back. And was going, nah. Isn't it?
Yeah. I really think it's like, suppose a legion of Roman soldiers materialize in the middle of New York City or something. Like, people know who Romans are. It's not going to... Yeah. It's, even though it's a long time ago, people, there's a cultural memory to these things, right?
I imagine that level of familiar, yeah, like really iconic history stuff that we would know. So, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily know a lot about them in detail, but they certainly know who they were, and there'd probably be a sense of, you know, this warrior race and everything else.
Just like in Monty Python when they write Go Home Romans, do you think someone's sitting around going, writing Go Home Vaudoir on the walls?
That's brilliant.
Go Home Vaudoir. So we've been talking about Dragon's Teeth for a while now. Did I manage to change your minds about Dragon Teeth even a little bit? Or are you being true to your natures and being stubborn about this?
No, sorry, Zach.
Like I said, I didn't hate the episode. It's a middle of the road episode for me. There are some nice moments. I do agree, there's some nice moments in there. There are some great character moments, and it's a great concept. But if anything, when I watch this episode, I just feel a bit disappointed that there's not a bit more to it.
I also think it suffers from being wedged between two really good episodes. Because you had Riddles right before it, and then One Small Step right after it. So that didn't help its case.
Now, see, One Small Step, I kind of have a hard time getting through. I don't find that as interesting as this episode. But that's a topic. That's a topic for another episode of To the Journey. But I totally want to talk about that because I totally disagree with you on that one.
Wow. I love how everybody has completely different opinions. Like, every episode is an episode somebody loves. And then every episode is also an episode that somebody hates. And I really love
Threshold.
That. I love that.
Yeah, those crazy people and Threshold.
Well, now that we've done, 27 episodes of To the Journey together, we have a lot of overlap, the three of us, in terms of what we like, but there are some differences, and we're willing to throw down and go all vaudoir on each other.
We are. And I'm afraid, Zach, Suzanne and I are declaring you officially vaudoir on this episode.
Exactly.
Well, don't count me out yet. I might be 9 centuries out of date, but I will.
That
I will
is the problem.
Thrive. I always knew I was born an old man. I think I was 900 years old, but
yeah.
Well, I look forward to our throwdown on One Small Step.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, it's been fun talking about Dragon's Teeth together, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek.fm. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere around the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
When Lieutenant Saru says, "I sense the coming of death." They could be playing "Staying Alive, Staying Alive" in the background.
They're like, "Whatever, man. BG Sam, Staying
We're
Alive.
Staying Alive. Aren't you listening to the sound system on this bridge?
Man, your bell bottoms too tight, boy."
That would be awesome if they had bell bottoms on the Discovery uniforms.
Meta Treks.
Garrick really typifies, personifies that snake-like way of kind of slithering around in the shadows, more subtle than any other character in the Star Trek universe.
Plain simple Garrick would be the first to say that the clothes make the Cardassian.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
This episode was actually banned by the BBC for many years, and they always said, I don't know if this is true, not so much because of the kind of allegorical significance of the episode, but because of this single line in it where Data says, he basically says, oh, well, you know, the IRA basically achieved what they wanted in, I think, 2024,
yeah.
You know, it's coming up.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on the iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or your desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link.
Well, we would love to hear any of your thoughts on today's show. And there are a lot of different ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. If you type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose message to a Trek FM show and select To The Journey. That will come to all three of us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So, Zach, when you're not trespassing in other people's subspace corridors, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and Voyager with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Suzanne, how about you? When you're not going for a stroll in the rain with your umbrella, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me occasionally popping up in the Babel Conference, or if you want to find me on Twitter, my handle is KJaneWay8. Kay, if someone would like to borrow your copy of L. Daxon's Collected Folklore, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me in the Babel Conference. And if they want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is ChocoWeeble.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, we'd like to thank the rest of the To The Journey team from around the network, our founder and publisher, C. Brian Jones, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Matala, our Patreon manager. We'd also like to give a really special thank you and a shout out to our three associate producers here on To The Journey, Bruce Lish, Drew Kim, and Richard Marquez. Thank you very much for your support of Trek FM.
Well, everyone, be sure to join us next week on To The Journey when we will be waking an ancient civilization with nanoprobes. But until then, this has been To The Journey.